revenge, retaliation, to avenge oneself, getting even. Movie makers love it, with titles and catchphrases like hit and run, revenge of the nerds, revenge of the ninja. Revenge will be theirs, the brave one, without remorse, the equalizer, the last revenge, sweet revenge. Shows like Star Wars, James Bond, X-Men, Avengers. Being a vigilante is definitely front row stuff. And we, the audience, eagerly await for the protagonist to get even. How many times have you heard the saying, eye for eye and tooth for tooth? Is not retaliation demanded of us? Commanded even? Because the Bible says so. So if you insult me, according to Scripture, I have to insult you back. After all, isn't it the golden rule that we should do unto others as they would have do unto you? So if you bump into me, I'll shove you back. And if you push in front of me, I'll push back in front of you and trip you up. And if you beep at me on the road, I will beep back twice as loudly and slam on my brakes. If you steal from me, I will sue you and take everything you own. If you're stuck on ideas on getting even, you can always Google it. I did. I found a range of options. Sink to their level and play dirty. Send anonymous letters. Make them feel stupid on the job. Watch them slip up and then draw attention to it. Sign the person up for spam emailing lists. Ship them tons of weird, cheap items from China. Hide something foul-smelling in their car. Spread rumours galore. Drip honey all over their stuff. Trash them on social media. The list goes on and on. Yes, we've all been there. Personal hurts can keep us awake at night, making us wonder how we can get even. You might think, I'm a big fan of forgiveness. As long as I've given the opportunity to get even first. It's easy to get angry and desire vengeance on people, even for the smallest things. You might have been in a relationship that ended badly. Paul talked on divorce last week. At one time, you used to talk about how wonderful this person was and how they were perfect for you. But now that the relationship has ended, you go out and tell everyone about their faults. You might have been bullied and then go to a reunion and see that time hasn't been kind to your bullies and you feel kind of good about it. At one time, you loved the church you attended, but you got hurt. And now you badmouth the church everywhere you go and you invite your friends to leave also. Yes, the desire for revenge can consume us. And many people will try to trip you up. But is this the right way to handle it when we are hurt and insulted? What would Jesus do? And what are we, as disciples of Jesus, called to do? Picture this. Jesus is on a hillside by the Sea of Galilee, explaining the nature of his kingdom to a crowd gathered around him. Much like here, except he'd be sitting down and they'd be standing. In this section of the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus focuses on correcting the people's misunderstanding of the law of God. Because in many cases, people thought that they understood it, but they had actually twisted it. So continuing on with our Sermon on the Mount series, we now find ourselves at the point on the discussion of the discussion on, you guessed it, revenge and retaliation. Let's read together. Matthew 5, 38 to 42. You have heard that it was said, eye for eye and tooth for tooth. But I tell you, do not resist an evil person. If anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to them the other cheek also. And if anyone wants to sue you and take your shirt, hand over your coat as well. If anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with them 2 miles. Give to the one who asks you, and do not turn away from the one who wants to borrow from you. Now, it's important to mention that prior to this passage, Jesus had used several other illustrations. For example, do not murder. And the people had thought, sweet, if I don't murder, I'm good with God. But Jesus corrects them and says, no, even if you harbour hate and murderous intent in your heart, you will not be good with God. You are not righteous. Of adultery, people thought, sweet, if I don't commit adultery in the flesh, I'm good with God. But again, Jesus says, no. Even if you just look lustfully at another person, you have already committed adultery in your heart. So the point that Jesus is reiterating over and over here is that it's not just the physical act itself, but it's what you harbour in your heart that's important. The people had twisted, changed, and misunderstood these commandments. And in his Sermon on the Mount, Jesus reinforces what kingdom people should act like. He explains these commandments and corrects their misunderstandings about the law. It is not just about the external act itself, but how we are internally in our heart that matters to have a right relationship with God. In this passage, there are several illustrations that Jesus gives us as to how we are expected to behave as his disciples when it comes to the topic of revenge. Let's walk this path together. My first point is to resist retaliation. We must pick a path. Either choose to respond to insults with love or return the insult with hate. Which path have you stepped out on? Matthew 5, 38 to 39, you have heard that it was said, eye for eye and tooth for tooth. But I tell you, do not resist an evil person. If anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to them the other cheek also. Jesus states, you have heard that it was said. Yes, the crowd would have heard this law many times as it was taught from the Old Testament in the synagogues of that day. The saying eye for eye is called the law of Talion and is mentioned 3 times in the Old Testament, in Exodus, Leviticus, and Deuteronomy. You can see them up there, and I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time on this, but my point is, these verses in itself, if you take it out of the context, the point is never memorize a Bible verse, right? Eye for eye and tooth for tooth, or tongue in cheek, really. But you can see if we had these verses on their own without understanding the context, we can easily misunderstand what was intended by these sayings. The problem in that day was misunderstanding. People changed the context in which this law applied and applied this to personal relationships. They interpreted it as an obligation. If you hit me, I have to hit you back. So what was intended? I'm glad you asked. Eye for eye and tooth for tooth was actually intended for use in the justice system of the day, in court or the civil government. It was not intended for personal relationships. Funny that. I've heard probably this saying, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, more out of church than in church. It was actually intended as a measure of punishment. Because if I take things into my own hands, I take it a lot further, right? If you beep at me, I beep at you, and I slam on my brakes. Eye for eye and tooth for tooth. It was meant to be equal. So when God spoke about this law in Exodus, it was given to the judges of Israel on how they should administer justice. It's about how justice should be done in society and should not be applied to our personal relationships. So if someone takes out your tooth, you can't take out all their teeth. And if one person takes out your eye, you can't take both their eyes, their arms, and their legs. This law was meant to limit how much could be taken, just punishment, right? Now, to note here, this was just an illustration. There's no evidence that I have found that actually says they used this as punishment in that day, where they actually took eyes and teeth from people. But Jesus, in his point here, is to correct this misunderstanding of putting this into our personal relationships. The law of talion was not given to encourage or justify revenge, but rather to limit the extent of revenge. It set a limit on how much you can take from the perpetrator. Note that it does not say you have to do it. But if you do, this is how far you can take it. The interesting thing about this is that the crowd that had gathered around Jesus at this time are not officials any longer. So he's actually taking this verse in Matthew and referring to the misuse people have in everyday context, instructing the people that within their personal relationships, outside of the judicial system, we are not to resist an evil person. For example, if anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to them the other also. Yes, we are all sinners. And we walk alongside evil people, evil behaviours, and people consumed by the need to avenge one another. Proverbs 4:16 says of an evil person, "For they cannot rest until they do evil. They are robbed of sleep till they make someone stumble." But Jesus says here to resist an evil person if we encounter them. And if we are slapped back, to turn the other cheek. So then what does that mean? Are we as Christians meant to be passive? Does he want us to be punching bags? No. The Bible talks about right-handed action, not left-handed, probably because the majority are right-handed, right? How many people are right-handed here? Yeah, quite a few, most of us, right? So if I slap you on the right cheek with my right hand, I have to back-slap you, right? A back-slap is not an injury, it's an insult. In the culture of that day, this is a sign of a deep insult. They would slap someone on the right cheek with the backhand across the face. An insult is often deeper than injury, right? An injury has an initial sting, but it heals. But if someone disrespects you, mistreats you, insults you, this lingers long after the injury. Now, if we are slapped, our natural desire is to insult back, right? But Jesus says, no, we are to resist retaliation, resist the urge to bite back. Now, Jesus isn't saying, walk around and let people abuse you. Jesus is not asking us to be passive. He says, if anyone slaps you. That's a big if. If is a possibility, and if I see it coming, I can avoid it entirely and not get slapped in the first place. If you see a slap coming your way, you are entirely okay to remove yourself from the situation. You don't have to pick up that phone call with your ex. I can see your invitation and say, no thank you. Nothing demands that I let you insult me, because self-defense is okay. In fact, the Bible teaches us that we have the right and responsibility to protect and defend ourselves and our loved ones. Even the disciples carried a sword with them for self-defense. The Bible is not against self-defense when it comes to our physical person. But you must bear the insults. If you do get slapped, insulted, we are asked to resist the temptation to insult back. If we insult back, we end up on the same team as the one who insulted us in the first place. So ask yourself, which team are you on? What path have you taken? What is your first step when you are insulted? I remember in school we had a zero violence policy. You might have this in your workplace as well. I was talking to Leon earlier, he said he has this. Essentially it means that if someone hit me on the playground and I hit them back, I would get just as much trouble as the person who started it. Probably because nobody was there to witness it. So it became that he said, she said kind of situation, and they were trying to avoid that. But what was encouraged when someone did hit you, if that happened, is that you would report it to a teacher who had the authority over all the students to then punish the bully for what they had done. In much the same way, Jesus clearly states here that we are not to retaliate, but rather give our grievances to God. And God, who has authority over all people, will be our vindicator. And we should trust him to do just penalty to that person. However, on the playground and in society, these authorities are in place, right? Much as they would have been in the day of Jesus to deal with crimes such as murder, physical abuse, harming an infant, and these crimes would still find themselves in the justice system. In fact, many of our modern expectations for equal justice and reparation find a basis in ancient Jewish law. These systems are there to ensure that crimes are justly dealt with, and people are deterred from continuing in that evil behaviour. The law of talion, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, was created to ensure that evil was contained. It serves to stop a person from committing further crimes. We need some kind of deterrent, right? Punishment was served to act as a warning to others, not as entertainment, but as discouragement for them to do the same. It prevented punishment being based solely on vengeance, because like I said earlier, human vengeance can be very unjust. What Jesus is doing here in this verse is correcting what people think of love. Love, grace, kindness, it doesn't need a law, but evil does. Evil needs to be contained. Jesus is saying, I don't want retaliation to be your first response. Resist retaliation. Resist revenge. Ask firstly, how can I be a peacemaker? How can I reply in love? Yes, the law is there to limit evil. I should turn my cheek when insulted, but the government shouldn't turn its cheek. Government is the place to deal with due punishment and restrain an evil person from damaging others. My first reaction shouldn't be that of retaliation. So that's why my first point is resist retaliation. we as disciples of Jesus need to not insult back when we are insulted. We are not to be overcome by evil, but overcome evil by good. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. says this, "For you see, in a real sense, if we return hate for hate, violence for violence, and all of that, it just ends up destroying everybody, and nobody wins in the long run. And it is the strong man who stands up in the midst of violence and refuses to return it. It is the strong man, not the weak man, who stands up in the midst of hate and returns love. Hate begets hate. Force begets force. Violence begets violence. Toughness begets toughness. And it is all a descending spiral, ending in destruction for everybody." Dietrich Bonhoeffer adds, "The only way to overcome evil is to let it run itself to a standstill, because it does not find the resistance it is looking for. Resistance merely creates further evil and adds fuel to the flames. When evil meets no opposition and encounters no obstacle, but only patient endurance, its sting is drawn, and at last it meets an opponent, which is more than its match. Of course, this can only happen when the last ounce of resistance is abandoned and the renunciation of revenge is complete. Then evil cannot find its mark. It can breed no further evil. It is left barren." Ever have an argument with your husband or wife? I do occasionally. But the best thing that we've found in our household is the first person who agrees is the one who kind of wins it. Do you know what I mean? Yeah? "You left the butter out." "Oh, yes, I did. Sorry, honey." Argument doesn't escalate. If I say, "You left the butter out." "Oh, yes, but you left the toast out yesterday," you know. It escalates. The best way to stop an argument is to return hate with love. Agree with them rather than adding fuel to the flame. Our first step, wherever possible, should be that of reconciliation, not retaliation. Love, not hate. To take the road less travelled. Once we resist the urge to retaliate, Jesus then calls us to respond selflessly. This is my second point. Matthew 5:40, "And I, Jesus, also ask of you, if anyone wants to sue you and take your shirt, hand over your coat as well." Now, in your Bible, this may be referred to as tunics and cloaks. Basically, it was just an inner and an outer layer, which would have looked similar to that in this image. According to Jewish law, you could sue me and take my tunic or shirt, but the law prohibited you from taking my coat or cloak. Because if you take my shirt and my coat, I'm... Shh, Paul, it's church. I'm beer. Yes, the laws of Israel say that you could take a person's shirt, but you had to leave their coat. Remember that a lot of people did not have a lot of coats of clothes in that day. So this may have been their only outfit and kind of their point of identity. It's all they owned sometimes. For poor people especially, their coat probably doubled as a blanket. So the aim of this law was to ensure that a person would not freeze and not be bare. It was a basic human right to have a coat. People would only usually sue for clothing if they had no money. And Jesus says here, if someone is so desperate as to sue you for your shirt, even though it's your legal right to hold on to your coat, sometimes you should give up your own rights and give them your coat too. Because we must act in the interest of others. And it's quite likely they are probably worse off than you. Regardless, if they were worse off or simply suing you for your shirt out of spite, Jesus is pointing out that our response should be one of love, one of peace, not one of resistance. We are called to relinquish our own rights, trusting that God will provide for us, not identify ourselves with material things, our coat, but the coat that God will provide for you. Care more for others than for yourself. William Barclay summed this up really well, so I'm going to quote him here when he says, "The Christian thinks not of his rights, but of his duties. Not of his privileges, but of his responsibilities. The Christian is a man who has forgotten that he has any rights at all. And the man who will fight to the legal death for his rights, inside or outside the church, is far from the Christian way." Wow. Jesus calls us to concentrate not on our own rights, not on our entitlements, but rather on our responsibilities. So what are our responsibilities as Christians? We need to sow into the lives of others, meet others where they are at, talk to them eye to eye, honour those in lower positions to you, make them feel special, because it's important what we focus on. Are you aware of those around you, or too caught up in your own battles that you miss the person right beside you who is in much greater need? If you focus on retaliation and vengefulness, this may well be the case. We are too busy, caught up in our own matters, to care for others around us. This brings me to my third point. Jesus calls us to give generously. Which path do you take when someone asks you for something? Do you walk around them? Or do you take the path of generosity? In verse 42, Jesus says, "Give to the one who asks you, and do not turn away from the one who wants to borrow from you." If you have the fiscal ability, and it might be fiscal, or it might be something else, you have the Christian responsibility to give to those who are in need, who wish to borrow from you. The ability equals responsibility. Yes, Jesus asks us to be willing to offer more than required, the shirt and the cloak. I wasn't sued for the cloak, just the shirt. And resist the temptation to be bitter over it. Likewise, when we see genuine need, we should give generously of what we have. Note, I say here, genuine need. Yes, Jesus is not asking us to be a soft touch. He is asking us to be a good steward of what we have. Augustine asked whether one should give money simply because one is asked, even when it is obvious it is going to the wrong cause. And most of us would agree with Aristotle, who says we should give to the right people, the right amounts, at the right time. Right? just because someone asks and you have it doesn't mean you should give it. If someone asks me to give them some money to buy cigarettes or alcohol, you are not expected to give what you have to support their habit. A degree of discernment is required here. Would you give anything to your children that they ask of you? Despite the silence of this sermon on that subject, we must distinguish between different sorts of people who want and need our money. I came across this illustration in another sermon and it sums it up perfectly. The Dead Sea has 10 times the salt concentration of the ocean. Has anyone been there? Oh, one, two, a couple of us, okay, or three, good. All right, few of us have been there. It's so salty that no plant or marine life can survive in this body of water, hence it's named the Dead Sea. Now, how did it become dead? Interestingly, the water that forms the Dead Sea comes from the ice caps of Mount Hermon. And when they melt, the water runs down and forms the Sea of Galilee. Now, you've heard of the Sea of Galilee. It's a living body of water, right? Because Peter, Andrew, James, and John were fishermen, yeah, in the Sea of Galilee when Jesus called them. So we know it has fish in it. The Sea of Galilee then releases water into the River of Jordan, where John was baptized. It refers to in the Bible about plants in that water. We know that water is a living body of water. And it deposits into the Dead Sea, which has no life. But how is it that living water turns into dead water? It's because the Dead Sea has an inlet but no outlet. Once it has received the water, the sun evaporates it and the intensity of the salt increases. Because the Dead Sea knows how to receive, but it doesn't know how to release what has been given. Likewise, if we don't have an outlet, what God has given to us will die in our hands. Jesus has asked us to be good stewards with what we have been given and to give of these things generously when there is genuine need. Don't be like the Dead Sea and dry up and die. It's continually getting smaller every day because it has no outlet. We need to give generously. This is summed up later in Matthew with this passage. Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth where moths and vermin destroy and where thieves break in and steal, but store up for yourselves treasures in heaven where moths and vermin do not destroy and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. Where's your treasure? What are you harboring in your heart? Is that heaven worthy? If you were paying attention, you would have noticed that I skipped ahead with my last point. And this is because I want to finish on Matthew 5, verse 41. As if you take anything from this sermon, is this point. Go the extra mile. If anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with them 2 miles. In that day, Roman law entitled any Roman soldier to stop a Jewish citizen and demand that they assist in carrying their load for 1 mile or 1,000 paces. I imagine that this law was often misused out of mere laziness or the Roman soldier being on a power trip. And the soldier... And when the soldier asked you to do this, you can be sure that you would count each and every pace. 1, 2, 3 to 1,000. I didn't want to walk more than that. How humiliating. And it wouldn't have been like our roads. It'd be like this kind of road or a cobbled street. And you'd be walking with a heavy pack and sandals on your feet, not the latest Nike shoes. So it probably wasn't all that fun. "Hey, you, carry my bag for me," would say the Roman soldier. And you would be obligated to do this. How humiliating and degrading for the Jew, especially when you just come out of slavery. 1 mile was all that the law stated you have to do. It was all that was demanded of you. But because it was a law, if you were called to do this, you must do it, or there'd be consequences. Funny that we just talked about vaccinations and masks. You may even recall this law in the march of Jesus to his death. Because Jesus is stumbling with the cross when Simon is called on by a Roman soldier to help carry Jesus' cross. That's an example of this in practice. But here in Matthew, Jesus clearly says, go above and beyond obligation. Don't just do the 1 mile that is asked of you. You should go 2 miles, double. Ugh. 2? And if you go 2 miles, some people might say, now, why did you go and do that? You've ruined it for all of us. You're messing it up. Now that's the new expectation. Now they're going to revisit that law. That's what the enemy does when you want to walk in excellence. He surrounds you with people who are upset by your excellent spirit, because excellence exposes mediocrity. They criticize you because they aren't willing to go the second mile that you went. People who live in mediocrity are irritated by those living in excellence and always try to get you to doubt whether that extra mile was worth it. Why did you do that? There's no reward in that. You don't get anything from it. But do you? The point in Jesus requesting here that Jews walk 2 miles was for them to show that they were different to the Romans. They did not demand, they offered. They did not compel, they invited. The children of Israel were operating from a different worldview, one of simplicity and goodness and virtue found in the God of Scripture. The Romans operated from a worldview of power, conquest, and greed. But Roman hearts could be won, one at a time, by simple acts of radical service that went contrary to the expectation. There are two people in this world, ordinary 1 milers and extra milers. Ordinary 1 milers accept mediocrity. Those are the people that say, C's get degrees. They're content with the bare minimum. But extra milers are people who live in excellence. They take it to the next level. They don't just concentrate on their outward, external behaviours, but also what they harbour in their heart. Here Jesus is asking of us to go above and beyond what is demanded of us and distinguish ourselves with second mile mentality. Yes, the first mile has been forced on you externally, obedience to the law. Do not murder, do not commit adultery, don't hit someone back. But the second mile is voluntary. It is an internal expression of a heart that wants to do more. Extra milers have a better attitude as they exceed what is asked of them and they surprise those around them. Because excellence isn't about performance, it's about attitude. Essentially, Jesus is saying here we need to adjust our attitudes to be more like Christ. Jesus asks us to go beyond obligation. The second mile is not an obligation. It's an opportunity. And too often we miss the opportunities that lie in doing the difficult. We quit too quickly. We want to get by with the absolute minimum. And ironically, if you do go the extra mile, you will be slapped and insulted more. So you'll need to resist retaliation. You'll need to respond selflessly for the positions in which you find yourself and give generously because you will have something to give. When you go above and beyond, the end result is that you'll be further blessed. So don't let the devil convince you that one situation is only worthy of 1 mile. Requirements from Jesus are not instinctual. They are countercultural. We need to be careful about what comes out of our mouths when we're angry. We need to have integrity. Let your yes be yes and your no be no. Forgive others when they do wrong. Stop looking and lusting. Love your enemies. These are not easy things. So if a man compels you to go 1 mile, go 2. This is the fourth thing that identifies you and having faith with God, exemplifying excellence, going the extra mile. When you are insulted, resist retaliation. Turn the other cheek. Don't just give your shirt when you have been sued for that you have been sued for, but give your coat also. Don't harbour bitterness in your heart. Respond selflessly. Don't just walk the other way and meet those on the path that are worse off than you. You need to help them. Give generously. Jesus calls us to go beyond obligation, beyond our natural instinct, to be extraordinary, to take the path less travelled, to go the extra mile.